This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in Indian Religions here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More about me at rajbalkaran.com. More importantly, my guest today is Dr. Rita Sharma, who's director and associate professor at the Center for Dharma Studies and also co-chair of Sustainability 360 at the Graduate Theological Union. Rita, welcome to the podcast.
Pleasure to be here and greetings from chilly Berkeley.
Indeed. We'll be speaking today about a fascinating, important new book on none other than Swami Vivekananda. It's called Swami Vivekananda, His Life, Legacy, and Liberative Ethics. Dr. Sharma is the editor of the book. It's by Lexington, published in 2021, which wasn't that long ago, considering we're now second week of January 2022 in real time. Tell us a bit about, I know there's a story about how this book came into being. Tell us about the backstory.
The book came into being as a result of Swami Vivekananda's 150th birth anniversary. So at that time, I was professor at, I was teaching at USC in Los Angeles. And the Hindu community raised the funds and asked if I'd be interested in doing something to commemorate his birth anniversary. And I said, well, I'm already planning to do that. I was planning to do a symposium. And they said, well, let's make it a really large symposium and get people from all over. So we had scholars from Europe, from the United Kingdom, from Canada, from India, Australia, and the United States. And so it became a very exciting conference. Now, all the papers were invited, and they're not all in the book. And sadly, you know, there were people who got very ill during this time after the conference. Some very valuable members of our cohort, including Joseph Prabhu, for example, died. And so did Gerald Larson. And these are huge names. And they would have contributed to the book. I still have their rough chapters. And so, you know, it's a very tragic thing that we lost so many people along the way. And because we were waiting for them to get well, and they didn't, you know, the book took this long to be published because, it just seems that you're talking about a person who taught compassion. Swami Vivekananda taught to do seva to others, you know, and to turn your moksha wasn't just about escape. Moksha was about a way of living in the world. Mumukshutva, the desire for liberation, was expressed not just through navel gazing, but through companionable, communitarian compassioning for the world. So now we're doing a book that talks about him, and I can't tell my my contributors. We have our own colleagues who are ill, but let's forget about it and move ahead, you know. So that delayed the book, but it was worth it. And I know their spirits are with us. They're, I know that, you know, their light is still with us. And so it was a very interesting effort, because you will find tons of books on Swami Vivekananda. So, you know, the first question you could have asked me is, Rita, why another book on Swami Vivekananda? Do we need another one? Well, what you really, two kinds of books. One is put out by his own monastic order, in other words, the Ramakrishna Order of Monks. And that monastic order is a very erudite order. And because it's erudite, there's a high quality to their work. But the thing is that it's not necessarily objective scholarship. In a way, it shouldn't be. You know, there has to be shraddha, a conviction, faith, respect for the tradition and for the person who carries the torch of the tradition, Swami Vivekananda. So there's that category of books. And then you have monographs, actually, by individuals who have written their viewpoint, which may be positive, negative, or neutral. But what you don't have a lot of, and this is surprising, is a body of work that integrates Indian and Western perspectives on this major figure coming out of the International Academy. So, you know, when we were researching this, when I was researching the volume, making a decision whom to invite and so forth, you know, I was so surprised. I said, well, there must be so many other edited volumes like this in the last 10, 15, 20 years. And I found one. And it, now that volume is, I think, nearly 30 years old. So the book presents the many different aspects of him, and it also reflects the different ways people perceive him and see him.
You know, one question that might sound obvious. I mean, certainly Swami Vivekananda needs no introduction insofar as the entire Hindu world, scholars of Hinduism, practitioners, those with Shraddha, as you say, would be well acquainted with the name Swami Vivekananda. But could you underscore for us why he was so important a figure? What is it about Swami Vivekananda that is so crucial and noteworthy, especially as pertains to this publication?
Yes. The thing is that, you know, you can look at him and see groundbreaking concepts, thoughts, and activities in, you know, with every step he made. Now, you may agree with them or disagree with them. That's not the point. The fact is, he kept on breaking ground. And he's not just a part of Hindu religious history or even Indian religious history. He is a part of American religious history. And I, as an American, am editing this volume, and I convened the conference from that viewpoint, that this book is about someone who is a pivotal figure in American religious history. So we have the 1893 Chicago Exhibition, the Columbia Exhibition, and you have the Parliament of Religions as, you know, affiliated with this. And there are so many people involved in it who, in terms of organizationally, who are from marginalized groups like Swedenborgians and, you know, so forth, and Unitarians and other, I mean, you know, and it's not surprising that they wanted to touch base and welcome other thought from, especially from Asia in this case. And the thing is that Swami Vivekananda, you know, anyone who is a historian of the Parliament of Religions, of the first Parliament of the World's Religions, will find that, you know, he's called the star of that, of the Parliament, because he took it by storm. He ended up being called to give talks all over the country, and he wasn't expecting all that. You know, he left India a fairly unknown monk, and he returned an international celebrity, you know, and that is America's pizza effect. So very much part of American religious history, very much one of the pioneers of the North American vision for pluralism, the history of the North American move towards multiculturalism in certain areas, especially in religious areas. And so this idea of the universal, of the possibility of the universal, which now we call, you know, perennialist philosophy, and we now say we're in a post-perennialist age. We have theology without walls, which is a new category. But, you know, it all ends up at the same place, in the sense that we might be going higher up, but we're standing, but the ground is the same. In other words, from the same location, we're going higher up. But where is that location? It's a location he created.
Fascinating. The anniversary, the 150th anniversary of the Parliament, took place in Toronto in 2018, I believe. And it was my first and last time contributing, because it was in my backyard. And it was a significant event. I was on a panel with some great scholars, my advisor, Beth Rollman, and Hillary Rodriguez. He's at Lethbridge, actually, where I'm currently teaching. And, you know, it was... there was something very special about the commemoration. It was great to participate to that dialogue and that space. And it really, I think, is difficult to imagine that what it took for him to contribute to that space and the impact he had, because we see it in hindsight. But can you imagine venturing out into a world that is entirely foreign to you? Like, it really is something quite monumental that he achieved, as you say, rags to riches overnight in terms of popularity. It's fascinating. In your introduction about the backstory to the book, you mentioned that, listen, we can't just write a book about Vivekananda. We're not just learning about tradition, we're learning from tradition, and this is an exemplar, and we should follow suit ethically, in terms of how we treat people and how we engage the world and people in it. So this is a really important theme, isn't it? Moksha is not just for the cave or the ashram, the pursuit of moksha. You know, without putting words in your mouth, unpack this.
So one of our presenters was Pravrajika Rajaprana, and she's a scholar. And she's also a nun of the Ramakrishna Mission, well, the order, the Ramakrishna Order. And the thing is that she has a chapter in the book which is really fascinating. And it's a chapter on his relationship or his attitude towards women. And her perspective is coming from within the order. She is an American woman who is a Hindu nun in America and a scholar of the field. It's really quite remarkable because before this, so, you know, one of the things that the book says is his life, it doesn't talk that much about his life. It does talk a lot about his legacy, and it talks a lot about his liberative ethics, which is, part of the title. Now, the thing is that part of his liberative ethics was the emancipation of women. And he took that very seriously. In fact, he has written about it in, if you look up, it's in his collected works. He's written a letter to one of his brother monks, and he says, you know, the reason that the West is ahead of India is because the West worships Shakti all the time, and we denigrate Shakti. So what, you know, when you first read that, you're like, what? Excuse me, West worshiping Shakti? What? He's talking about women. What he says is, everywhere I go, the door is open for women, and that the women are the first to be placed on a table. Women are the first to be asked, what would you like to have for dinner? You know, that what feminists consider a very problematic and destroyed 20 years ago, 30, maybe 40, before I was, before my time. But at that point, for him to see that coming out of a highly patriarchal Bengali culture, where women were the servants, were serving, dasis. And there was a Devi-dasi dichotomy. Yes, you had yoginis who were gurus. Yes, the master of Swami Vivekananda, the spiritual master of Swami Vivekananda, his first guru is a woman. So she's a tantric yogini, she's a shakta, she's a yogini, she's, you know, very erudite, and Vivekananda praises her and so forth, but she is a Devi. You have a Devi-Dasi dichotomy. Dasi means servant, Devi means goddess, and if you are really advanced, if you are erudite, if you are special in some way because of privilege or because of your own efforts, you become Saraswati, you become Durga, you become Shakti herself embodied as a woman. But if you're not that, which is 99% of normal women, you're dasi. You're the server. And he's used to this, and he comes to the West and he sees it's the opposite, you know. And so, yes, women are still at home cooking and so forth. But the circles that he's moving in, I don't know that he's aware that he's in these very privileged circles, but the women of those circles, it's not just servants who are saying, madam, what would you like to have or whatever. It's men as well who are, you know, giving women that privilege of place. Now, that is a highly problematic, sophisticated patriarchy that feminists have teased out and, you know, unpacked. But we're talking about a long time ago, you know, so, and at his point, from his perspective, this is a worship of Shakti. That's what we do when we do Kumari Puja, when we worship a young girl as a physical embodiment of the goddess. And she's treated as such. She doesn't have to do anything special for it. She doesn't have to be super educated or a yogini or a guru, she's just a person. And we take her and we worship her as an embodiment. And Sri Ramakrishna did that to his wife, who wasn't a 12-year-old, but she was a grown, she was an adult woman when he did the worship. So that is there in the tradition. We have nearly 30 rishikas, sages, in the Rig Veda, I would say the pan-Hindu authoritative Shruti or revelatory textual tradition of the Vedas. And we continue to have philosophers in the Upanishads, but it begins to diminish. Then we have a renaissance of women leaders during the Bhakti movement of the medieval era. So it's not that it's not there, but what you don't see is monastic women. So you do have gurus and yoginis and rishikas and so forth, you have monastic women. So Shankaracharya begins Hindu, you know, sort of a systematic Hindu monastic orders, the dasanami, you know, the orders, and then Vishishta Dvaita follows suit, Dvaita follows suit, and then we just keep going. And so Sri Ramakrishna followed suit, but what did Vivekananda do? The first time in Hindu history that you have women being ordained not as yoginis, rishikas, or gurus, but as nuns. That's the first time. The Buddhists already had this going on in India. The Jains already had this going on in India, but we did not. Perhaps we felt we didn't need it because we had the yoginis and so forth. But he felt we needed it because they were part of a systematic tradition and a systematic theological order. That was a massive step. Now, you also see the very first time that you have women religious leaders, which is what nuns are, in America, who are Hindu women, but who are Western. All of this becomes part of American religious history and Indian religious history.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Fascinating. Definitely an important bridge in the history of religions. There are four sections of the volume. Tell us how it's organized, the overarching themes that organize the work.
The book, you know, it was very difficult to make a decision on how to organize the book because you could have organized it in many different ways. But I was more interested in organizing it according to the arguments about him, if that makes sense. So, you know, there has been very... You know, it's surprising, but those who are not familiar, I should probably explain why briefly. But Vivekananda is really a contested figure. And so one of the things that has been argued about, one of the contestations, is that he's not really Hindu in the sense of being in that Vedic tradition. And definitely not Advaitin, as in the Shankarite tradition. And so what is he? He's just Neo-Vedanta, which is not really authoritative and not really valid. Now, my point is that if you have that perspective, then how is Reform Judaism valid? you undermine Reform Judaism. You undermine Mormon or the Church of the Latter-day Saints. You undermine even Methodist denomination. I mean, so much of Christianity is recent. So much of the American Jewish denominations, vast number of people are in recent denominations like Reconstructionist and Reform and even modern Orthodox and conservative. None of these are ancient, okay? These branches. Now, they will argue that they are ancient. It's just that they are, you know, in a stream of interpretation that they're part of the Jewish reception history, part of the Christian reception history. And what they're doing is they're receiving it and experiencing it and transforming it in the contextual moment. So why can't Hindus do that? Is that the privilege only of other people? You know, so the arguments that are made by several people, but most particularly James Madeo, for example, makes this argument in revisiting appraisals of Vivekananda. James Madeo makes this argument that, you know, he is between Shankara and Vivekananda is 1,000 years, okay? A millennium has passed. In that, that's a millennium of reception history. And if you look at the name of the chapter is Neglected Advaitas, the genealogy of Swami Vivekananda's cosmopolitan theology. What he's trying to say is Advaita Vedanta itself was moving in this direction, a more liberative, more emancipatory, more inclusive direction over that millennium to begin with. And then it ends up at Swami Vivekananda. And so it's not, he receives it. He's part of the reception history, part of the stream as a river that keeps running. That's what, you know, theological traditions are. They're not cast in stone. So, you know, Sharda Sugirtha Raja is also in that section on revisiting appraisals of Vivekananda. Jeffrey Long talks about complementarity, not contradiction, Swami Vivekananda's theology of religions. You know, people have a problem. Some people have called him an Advaita supremacist because he says that, you know, he doesn't want a Christian to become a Hindu or a Muslim to become a Hindu. He wants a Muslim to become the best Muslim and the Christian to become the best Christian. But what he means by that is to go into contemplative practices and contemplative approaches to these traditions, which would elicit the not just an intellectual, but perhaps an intuitive, a contemplative experience of divinity, which transcends finite comprehension. And, you know, Sri Ramakrishna said very much the same thing, and he hasn't been attacked for it. But because Vivekananda, you know, spoke so much more about it, I think that when he says that, you know, everyone's going up the same mountaintop, essentially, but the mountaintop, when they reach the peak, it's Advaita Vedanta. He's not talking about Shankara's, you know, systematic theology. He's talking about the Brahman of the Upanishads. And he's not talking about Hindu texts and Hindu conceptions. He's talking about the infinite Purnam. So this is, and then, you know, another section is legacy of service. And that too, you would think that is not a, you know, contested area, but it is a contested area because in India today, a lot of service organizations that are based in, you know, that are affiliated with right-wing politics see Vivekananda as an inspiration. And So his organizational legacy, with particular reference to Seva, they've appropriated it. So that's not, whenever service is done and whenever compassionate care is given, whoever is giving it, that's good. But, because in some cases there's political affiliation and alignments, it has become, his legacy of service itself has become a place of contestation. And then going back to part one, Vivekananda in relation to Hindu philosophies and major thinkers, this is very important because, again, we start with this problem of the word Neo-Vedanta, Neo-Hind, Neo-anything, coming out of any ancient tradition, whether Christian, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, whatever, because these are streams. These are very, wide, long, ancient streams, and they keep on changing, and you never step into the same river twice. So you have to look at the entire river of the reception history, the tributaries that feed it, and see what is his relationship as a thinker, as a philosopher, with the different streams that feed the reception history of the Hindu world and Hindu philosophies in general.
Arvind Sharma has some interesting thoughts to conclude the volume. What is it that he says? Do you agree with it? How do you bring all this together?
I gave my contributors a lot of freedom, except when it came to citation style and references. There I was a tyrant, right? But when it came to the way that they conceived of him, I did not run interference, because I wanted to showcase the variety of views. And some of them I will agree with, and some of them I didn't agree with, but that's all right. So Arvind Sharma's perspective on Hinduism is well known to me because we know each other very well, and we've published together as well. I have a different perception. I suppose that his perspective on what it means to be Hindu is based on, it's based on his self-perception as Indian Hindu. Although he's been in Canada for longer than I was in school, he sees himself as an Indian Hindu. And it's impossible for us, Raj, I think you will agree, to grow up in North America and not be North American. It's impossible. And so if we are North American Hindus, then we have to accept this concept of at least, if not a religion, at least a spiritual tradition. We're going to be looking for our roots. We're going to be looking for those tributaries that take us right back to the headwater, because otherwise we have no identity. And so if you're looking at it from the Indic point of view, the Indian point of view, then you look at the history in India, you see all of these syncretisms and so forth, and you say, well, anyone who says they are Hindu can be said to be a Hindu. Anyone, in fact, who says, this is Arvind Sharma's perspective, that if you have to basically say, I'm not a Hindu, in order for him and many other people to say, okay, you're not a Hindu. But if you don't say that, but from my point of view, that's like an anonymous Hindu. I am not going to walk down the street and I'm not going to look at people and say, anonymous Hindu here and anonymous Hindu there. To me, being Hindu means something very, very specific. It means being in that very wide river that has its headwaters in the Vedas and then keeps on collecting tributaries. And so there are recognizable theological, theoretical, you know, knowledge system, epistemologies, ontologies, these are recognizable across Hindu traditions. And you can see the distinction between them and even Jaina traditions, even Buddhist traditions. You can see distinctions. And the foundational distinction, I mean, I received and accepted an Avalokiteshvara initiation a very long time ago from the Dalai Lama. And I practiced in the tradition for a while. And it's still very much a part of me, the Vajrayana. But I'm a Hindu. And that, you know, what that does is it enhances my sense of the divine feminine in the Hindu context.
But there's so many, there's so much that comes to mind. Sorry to interrupt you. Please continue.
No, I just wanted to mention that if you don't want to put any boundaries, the old joke goes, you want to have an open mind, but not so open that your brains fall out. So the idea is you have porous boundaries. We know that. Every tradition, culture, and even human being has porous boundaries. But there are boundaries nonetheless. Even if we want to pull them down, we'll end up creating new, yes, porous boundaries.
I'd like you to underscore this legacy of service. Why is that so distinct? Is it distinct? Isn't Seva perennially Hindu? What's Vivekananda doing that's so marked and discernible?
You know, that's a great question, Raj, because very recently, a few weeks ago, I had a Hindu-Jewish conversation on justice, and I brought up the Dharma Shastras and the Nibandhas. And so, you know, you had this tradition of lineages of what we would call essentially the law books, right? Dharma Shastras. But they're not law by themselves. They are law as in having their ground in spiritual doctrines. Now, they're supposed to be in alignment with Dharma. And Dharma is the most important word probably in Hinduism and Buddhism and Jainism. Now, but they don't mean the same thing everywhere. Dharma Shastras or the law codes, the codes of customs, the kings used them. Governance used those Dharma Shastras and supported Nibandhas, which are commentaries to change the codes in accordance with time and region and place. But when we had, you know, wave after wave of, different groups of people coming into India and setting up new kingdoms and new codes, and finally, when the British colonial governance established itself, the Dharma Shastras basically became completely redundant. They died, essentially, historically. They were thrown in the dustbin of history, which is unfortunate because it's worth tracing. And Arvind Sharma does a brilliant job with this kind of work. He has done a lot on this, is trace the Dharma Shastras into its theological roots, into its philosophical roots. So the idea of ethics and the idea of seva and service, and if you ask me, well, what's the big deal about Vivekananda and service? I mean, were Hindus never taking care of each other? Were they just letting people die all over the streets? What, you know? Well, the thing is that the Hindu worldview in terms of rights, especially the American, I think Canada is a little bit much more balanced in this. In the United States, everything begins with your individual rights, even if those individual rights lead to not liberty, but license. And that license takes away my rights, not only to flourish, but to be alive. Okay? So this is a one perspective on ethics and care within the context of a greater community, rights orientation. The Hindu world had a responsibilities orientation. The idea of dharma was the right discharge of sacred responsibilities. And what are the sacred responsibilities? Every single relationship you have. In this moment, my sacred responsibility is to you and to your listeners. In another moment, it's to my students. In another moment, it's to my children, and so forth. So the idea of dharma is you fulfill your responsibilities and everybody's rights will be looked after. So in that way, everyone's continuously performing seva, but in relation to, in alignment with their particular relationships. So if you're a teacher, the seva is to the students. If you're a doctor, it's to your patients and so forth. Now, with Vivekananda, what he did is, I don't care about your personal life. You must do seva there. You must. That's your dharma. In addition to that, I tell you, he said, the daridra, you know, the mukha, and everybody on this planet deserves your service in addition to what your responsibilities are already.
Beautiful and inspiring thought. We're close to time for today. So I want to ask, was there anything else about the work of Vivekananda that you wanted to touch on?
Yes, I wrote a chapter for the book, which I then decided not to publish because I've decided that's going to be the core of a book that I'll be writing on him, in his relationship to Shakti or the divine feminine, the divine mother. And, you know, he didn't talk about it often, but he talked about it enough so that one can actually glean a mystical theology of the divine feminine from Vivekananda's many allusions to her.
That quite resonates for a number of reasons. For years, I've mused, of course, I don't study Vivekananda. I study the myths of Shakti. But I mused for some time that this was his guru was Ramakrishna, a mystic in trance, inebriated with the blackness of Kali, you know, the dark of the night. He was, you know, drunk half the time by all accounts. And so clearly this must have powered his path. And one of the things that came to mind as you were speaking earlier, and I tend to not interrupt speakers, obviously, is, yeah, he's not a Vedic priest. He's not part of the formal order, but he's received the transmission of this Shakta Tantric Guru. And that's got to count for something. And I've always suspected he was very purposefully not forthcoming about the authority or his perceived authority, his platform from which he spoke. So I think I suspect there's much to be gleaned from what you're looking at. I'd love to hear more about it and certainly have you on the podcast to discuss it when it's out.
Well, it's been a pleasure, Raj, as it always is. And my next book, which I'm just about, you know, submitted, is called Radical Immanence and Ecological Emancipatory Theology of the Divine Feminine in Hinduism, obviously. So that will, what we just discussed, will be touched upon there as well.
Fantastic. We'll have to have you back. Thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure, as always. Thank you.
For those of you listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Rita Sharma, editor of this brand new Lexington 2021 publication on Swami Vivekananda, his life and his legacy. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep reading, keep listening, and keep contemplating the impact of Swami Vivekananda. Take care.